It's kind of early to get in a lot of details because we don't have the governor's budget yet. The budget that's on the table is from the previous governor, and the new governor is going to totally rearrange that, and we'll be starting with a committee substitute. In other words, we'll take the budget that Walker had put together and the new governor modified a little bit, and we'll basically have that set aside, and we'll start fresh with whatever document Governor Dunleavy puts forward for us to review. That'll keep some of the confusion down. Everybody will have the same sheet of music. They might not like the song, but they'll all be looking at the same sheet. I don't know if we'll have that budget on the table on the 15th of January or later, but they're going to get it to us as soon as they can, and then we'll start right away working on the operating budget. And I expect we'll be in session the full 121 days.
Okay. Have you had any, I mean, other than what was said during the campaign, have you had much of an inkling of where the governor is going to go with his budget?
I haven't had any formal or informal meetings with Governor Dunleavy on the budgets, but I've worked with him for several years in the Senate and sat next to him on the floor for several years and was a friend of his in the Senate. I expect him to take a very conservative approach to the budget. He may, as referenced in some of the news articles, match expenditures with the reoccurring revenue. That's a nice way to say we'd be looking at a $1.6 billion reduction from the basically $5.9 billion or $5.7 billion, somewhere in there. That would be roughly a 30% hit in ballpark figures. That'll be huge and very difficult to deliver, but we'll see what he puts forward. It's easy to make campaign promises or get wrapped up in campaign rhetoric. It's a whole different issue when you have to shift gears and actually administer the state, and you have constitutional requirements that you have to deliver, and you have statutory obligations that you must fulfill. So it's not as easy as just, I'm going to take $100 million out of Project X. If Project X is required by the Constitution or by statute, most likely it will get done and the bill will be sent to us and we'll pay the bill. So there'll have to be a lot of statutory reevaluation work done and repeal work done to really get to the point where you can have a $1.6 or $1.7 billion reduction from where we're at, in my expectations and opinion.
And how feasible is it to cut another $1.6 billion out of the budget, because the legislature and the previous governor had already made some pretty significant cuts leading up to this year?
Well, the easy reductions are done. The positions that were never filled, the empty chairs, not counting them, taking away the loose cash, cutting back the capital budget. All the easy stuff's done. Oh, and then spending down $14 billion in savings, which I think is horrible personally, out of the CBR and the Constitutional Budget Reserve and the Statutory Budget Reserve, leaving us about, roughly in ballpark terms, $2 billion left in savings. So we've, over the last several years, have basically just been living on our savings that we had put aside back in my previous role as chairman of the Finance Committee several years ago. That leaves us with the very difficult decisions of actual budget reductions through program changes or looting the permanent fund. And looting the permanent fund is not where I'd like to see us go. I think we should be protecting the permanent fund at all costs. And I think we should also have a discussion at some point over the next 3 months of taking a substantial amount of the earnings reserve, or the unconstitutionally protected portion of the permanent fund, which is somewhere around $17 billion, and rolling it into the constitutionally protected portion, especially if the legislature is unable to make the tough decisions to keep out of making ad hoc draws or draws out of the permanent fund that are unsustainable, which would be somewhere north of 5% of the market value of the fund.
Okay, and that was actually one of my other questions. You've said before that you would like a constitutional protection for the perm fund, and you're still on board with that, sounds like.
I'm more concerned about the protection of the permanent fund than I am the dividend. If we protect the permanent fund, the dividend survives. If we concentrate on the dividend, we could erode and hurt the permanent fund for future generations. So I haven't changed my position that I had since last spring, and quite frankly, ever since I became your senator, pushing for a percent of market value approach to managing the permanent fund and blocking the legislature's ability to go over a set percentage of withdrawals per year. Right now we're looking at 5% or 5.25% coming down to 5% per year. And then the conversation should be, how do we split that between the populace and the need for core services? And I support a 50-50 split. Share it, one half to dividends and one half to the state core services. And if it's education or if it's, you know, health and welfare or roads or whatever we're going to do, there's enough need for that. I think if we take the approach that some of my colleagues have had, that we should milk the permanent fund for everything we can get out of it, is dangerous, and it's the wrong way to do the analytical review of it. The permanent fund should be reviewed in isolation from the budgetary needs of the state, and the permanent fund should be set up to run in perpetuity, peel off a dividend to the citizens, and as it was originally envisioned, help the state when the expenditures exceed the revenue. And that amount should be set, again, outside of the needs of the state. And whatever that number defaults out to come into the state budget, that's what it is, and we just have to live with it. And so I'll be continually advocating that throughout the year. And it'll be a dynamic discussion within the legislature, the permanent fund. My concern, quite frankly, is the legislature's easiest course of action is to loot the permanent fund and not do the budget issues they're faced with until such time as the earnings reserve is gone. And that's a huge policy error and should not be able to be allowed to go forward.
Now, you said that you're less concerned with the PFDs, but the current governor was elected in large part on promises of full PFDs. How are you going to work to kind of balance out what you're hoping to do with what he had promised to do?
Well, I don't work for the governor. I'm in a separate branch of government, an equal branch, by the way. The legislature is with the governor. He is one and we are 60, but we are each equal. I would make sure that we're defining my position accurately. When it comes to the concern of the dividend, I'm more concerned of the permanent fund in the entirety versus the dividend itself. I am concerned of the dividend, but if you just concentrate on the dividend and take your eye off of the earnings reserve where the money's at, the money's going to be gone. And then your dividend will follow because your dividend comes out of the earnings reserve, which is trading profits and dividends. And if there's no trading profits and no dividends, corporate dividends coming into the permanent fund portfolio, there is no earnings reserve, and there is no dividend, and there is no money to help the state. So the first priority is ring-fence the permanent fund and decide how to manage it and allocate it, and then have the discussion of what we're going to do with our budget. The Governor Dunleavy's campaign promises of paying dividends in arrears, I think, is going to be an interesting discussion when the public realizes the magnitude of the financial impact to the state and how difficult it is going to meet our budgetary obligations. So I don't put a high priority on that or high probability of that passing the legislature. Anything's possible in politics, but I would put it as a lower probability. I'd put a high probability on the statutory formula used to calculate the dividend. And Governor Dunleavy's interest in doing what historically we've done for years is pay the statutory required amount. I think that's highly likely to happen. It's about $3,000 a piece If we went to a more conservative percent of market value approach and split 50-50, the dividend would be somewhere around 2,000 or a little bit north of 2,000. I think having a dividend at the 1,200 range or $1,600 range has a very low probability.
Okay. So dividends will be higher this year.
I would expect.
This coming year. Yeah.
I'll be surprised if they're not the statutory amount at 3,000. Going forward, I'd like to see that structure change in the permanent fund, again, to a more constitutionally protected percent of market value approach. Historically, the dividend payout on 50-50 with that and the earnings reserve or the current calculation is fairly close over time. The payout this coming year, that 3,000 versus somewhere down around 2,000, is a little out of whack because we've had a huge run-up in the stock market. And when you have, for several years, when you have several years of crummy markets, the percent of market value approach would actually pay a higher dividend in crummier financial market times. But this year, it's not the case. And I think we need to look at the long-term averages over decades, not just what's going to happen this year, and then make a structural change to the permanent fund that might last for generations over it.
Another kind of big thing that I don't even know how much it affects the Senate is the lack of a House majority. At what point does that affect what the Senate is trying to do as well?
I'm in full support of the Senate just, ignoring the House and taking care of business and having the House rubber stamp our work. I have trouble getting support in the House to do that. So we'll work with the House, whatever organization they put together. And if it goes a little bit to the left, there'll be more difficulty in dealing with programs and balancing budgets. And if it goes more to the right, they'll be more in line with the Senate and the governor, and things might run a little smoother, but we'll still have very difficult votes and very, very close votes. So it's going to be very turbulent throughout the winter, regardless how that organization goes together in the House. I think the split's going to be very close, regardless. So they have not, their inability to put an organization together has not slowed the Senate down at all. In fact, it's actually speeded us up in relocating our offices and getting the Senate structure in place, because all of the workers that help rejigger the Capitol building itself are not busy with the House. They don't know who's going to be in what office. So the Senate will be ready to work on the 15th of January, and if the House doesn't have an organization, we'll start our process and they'll work diligently when they get organizations to catch up.
Okay. So it doesn't really affect you guys that much?
No.
Okay. All right. Some somewhat big news that came out recently was regarding the ferry system and all the money that's going to be needed to reconfigure the two new ferries that have been built, et cetera. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the deal and the negotiations that Representative Bill Thomas and myself had with the previous governor on that original appropriation of $120 million, which is where it came from, should have been left as it was intended, which was for one ship initially. The governor got the one ship that was SOLAS certified so it could go to Prince Rupert and other places south across the Gulf, whatever. That was then changed to two ships for the same price with the road extension out of Juneau. Those ships were, in my opinion, the margins were too tight for the shipyard. They were squeezed too much, trying to get too much bang for your buck, in my opinion. And anyway, so we've got the two ships. Now we have no road extension out of Juneau. We have no berthing capacity on those ships. And we have basically a $30 million bill to put berthing capacity on them, and another roughly $15 million to do shoreside improvements. And then I think there's might be another bill from the shipyard on the finishes. Most ships have little overages here or there, or contract issues. So whatever that number is, expect it to be in the millions. I'd be surprised if there's not. So we're looking north of 45. I'd say probably closer to 55, maybe 60 million. I think we're serving up a political football to the rail belt to beat us up with. And we're going to have extremely tight budgets the next few years. If the governor wants to match revenue with expenses with recurring revenue, which private enterprise does, they set the revenue and then do their budget. Governments do their expenditures first and then figure out their revenue. They do it upside down. So anyway, that would mean a $30 million roughly reduction in the operating funds of the Marine Highway, which would be pretty devastating. And maybe they'll take more out. I don't know. Most of the general fund money for DOT is in the Marine Highway. So I think it's going to be a full-on battle through the winter. And I hope that the district realizes that as the operating budget chairman, which in the Senate, which is my role the next 2 years, my job is to put an operating budget together that the governor will sign and get enough votes in the Senate and a negotiated agreement with the House. So by the Constitution, we have to have a budget by July 1. In doing so, there's going to be changes to the Marine Highway, and there's going to be changes to that funding level that I personally would prefer to have less of. In other words, more funding for the Marine Highway. And that budget is going to sit on the Senate floor for a vote. My good colleagues and friends like to have sporting events from time to time. And that's not watching football or basketball, but that's making amendments to the budget that affects the chairman of the operating budgets district, the Marine Highway, that then I'll have to get up, argue against, and vote no. So I expect my colleagues in good jest to have some nice amendments for me that would be very beneficial to my district, and I'll be not supporting them, because my job is to get a package together that we can get legislative support for and the governor's signature on. So when you see Senator Stedman voting against Marine Highway amendments on the floor of the Senate, it's not that I turned into Benedict Arnold. It's the role I've taken on knowingly as the operating budget chairman. And I would have to go back. I think the last time anybody from Southeast did the operating budget would have been in the early 1970s.
Oh, wow.
And before that, it would have been in the early 60s. Hmm. And the 70s guy would have been Bill Ray out of Juneau. And the 60s would have been Howard Bradshaw out of Sitka, and before him, Nolan out of Wrangell.
Hmm.
So knowing that my colleagues like to have sport, I took this job as operating budget chairman. And we'll take it in jest, but I will be opposing, I expect to have my colleagues put forth amendments that I would really like to have in the budget, but we'll be unable to keep a balance and get a budget across the governor's desk.
So they really just do that just for fun?
Sure, why not? and
I guess you gotta have fun somehow.
Yeah,
right?
Well, they know it's not gonna pass. You know, we know normally the budget work is done in committee. When we get the budget on the floor of the Senate, there's amendments. They go down in flames one after the other after the other. They're mainly political statements. The decisions were made previously and hopefully thoroughly discussed. We get a little testy if the minority puts an amendment that they didn't on the floor that they didn't ask us about in committee for discussion. That's not fair. That's not nice. You know, that's a dirty pool. It's not dirty pool to put amendments on the floor. You just want to make sure that they've had the chance to discuss them in committee and make their decisions, and that they're political decisions, and you go on. But you're going to have them, and you know, the last several years, our Senator Egan would make the Marine Highway Amendment. And Gary Stevens out of Kodiak and myself would vote against our caucus in support of the Marine Highway, knowing that those amendments were never going to pass, because we knew what the votes were when we walked in the room. But it's very critical to our district and to support our transportation system, and we would do that. This year, I will be opposing virtually every amendment put forward for the operating budget on the floor of the Senate. That's my job. If there's an error in the budget, then we'll support it and fix the problem. Senator Stevens out of Kodiak may or may not support the Marine Highway Amendment. I would expect him to support it. It's good politics for his district, and I'll have to vote no, and you'll have the opportunity in end of May, first part of June, ask Senator Stedman, why in the world did he not support the Marine Highway?
Well, so I just thought I'd get that out there. You've given us fair warning.
I've given you fair warning.
Yeah. And then the whole process of changing the Marine Highway's management system, it seems like the whole mess up with the ferry design concept that got changed with every governor. Could have been avoided with that. So this, it seems like it's more of an argument for changing that management structure.
I think you can make a good argument for that, but it doesn't answer the dangerous waters that we put the Marine Highway in, and that's the difficulty of the appropriation for the subsidy to run it. And unlike the railroad, and they throw the railroad out there all the time, The Alaska Railroad is a real estate company that happens to own a railroad. The Marine Highway is not going to get a real estate endowment, and they're not going to get a cash endowment. And they've also haven't sat down with the labor unions and talked about how they're going to work with them on this restructuring. They virtually are our partners. They have a lot of control of that entity. So, and until you sit down and work something out with the labor unions and you deal with how you're going to get the appropriation through the legislature with any predictability, that whole plan is very, very dangerous. And frankly, I think it would be easier to cut the Marine Highway's throat with that current plan in place than it is today. Hmm. It'd be easier just to take the subsidy away and tell them they're on their own.
Okay.
So don't stand up and salute too quick. You might find yourself sitting on the beach with no ferry anywhere. So those questions, when the Senate starts working on that bill, Senator Stevens and myself have had numerous discussions on it. We're going to take a very keen interest in what position the Marine Highway is going to be in dealing with the population centers of the state and how we get appropriations.
Okay. All right.
Well, good ideas have problems sometimes in the details.
Well, there's always a loophole somewhere.
And the issue with the Marine Highway is the money. It's all about the money. The money that goes to the subsidy and doesn't go to Anchorage, Matsu, and the rest of the rail belt for DOT. That's all it is. And if you don't recognize that, then you'll be playing one set of cards, and the other guys and gals are going to play another set of cards, and you'll lose the game.
Okay. Is there anything else that you wanted to discuss or address leading up to the legislative session?
I think it's going to be one of the most turbulent and controversial sessions in years. I hope that the public takes the opportunity to kind of watching the process and government at work. It's very messy. But at the end of the day, our expenditures far exceed our recurring revenue. And we can't just take the money out of the permanent fund until it's gone. The earnings reserve is gone to fund it. We've got to fix the problem. I would prefer we do it over, several years step down versus one bomb down the chimney like the Japanese dropping the bomb down the Arizona's smokestack. But I think that's pretty much what's coming. And we're the Arizona.
Southeast?
No, the state in general. Operating budget in general. So I expect the windows will be blown out of the building and budgetary-wise, not literally. And that will start a rigorous discussion and debate internally on how we deal with the problem. But I'm going to try to put as many supporters as I can together within the legislature to lock up the permanent fund, because I am not interested in the permanent fund being spent down because we can't make the hard decisions like we did when we spent down the $14 billion out of the other savings accounts. It doesn't work. And if oil is $60 or oil is $50 or oil is $40, you know, we can't control that. So we're just going to have to deal with it. No, I've really appreciated being a senator for the last 14 or so years in Southeast. You couldn't ask for a greater place to be a senator and be able to run around in different islands in Southeast and try to help the economy and build the communities. And you can see it all across the region. I'd like to see some enhancements, additional enhancements. And one of the things I'd really like to see built in Ketchikan is a synthetic ball field for the younger, wouldn't say kids, but the younger Ketchikanites, both men and women. And I want to see it lit. I want to have nice dugouts. And I want to have covered bleachers for the parents. I want it on par with the field that's in Sitka, Moeller Park, which is on par with some of the fields in Anchorage. These items get built in the Anchorage area, and they get vetoed out of the budget in rural Alaska. So we took a very aggressive position after several vetoes on Moeller Park and Sitka and put it in the Anchorage appropriation. So they would have to veto Anchorages to get to ours. I'm willing to play the same aggressive game to deliver a synthetic field to Ketchikan. And I've asked both the city and the borough if they would consider the need and the benefit of the youth for that type of a facility and to put it on their request. And it may not come this year, may not come next year, but before I ride off to the sunset, I'd really like to see that done. We have built very nice fire halls in the community here, a library that stands out all across the state, a huge development on the waterfronts and road improvements all over. We have we should not overlook our youth. We have issues with, obviously, you know, drugs and mayhem in the younger generation. And I think we should be looking at putting in a facility that will give them something else to do on the dark days, play baseball and frisbee or whatever other games they want to play on a nice field. Oh, and it needs to drain water, too. Sitka drains water very well, and we need a similar field here. So it doesn't matter if it's pouring down rain in Ketchikan. Turn the lights on and play. Kids will play. Yeah. They don't care.
They do now.
Yeah, they do now. And that, by the way, that's the same field that I played in when I came here in the All-Stars, Little League All-Stars in 1968 from Petersburg. We got thoroughly trounced down by Ketchikan, beat by both Ketchikan's All-Star teams, the first string and the second string. Went home totally humiliated. So when I leave the Senate office, I'd really like to see that field that I lost so poorly on completely renovated and changed so it's unrecognizable.
Excellent. That's a good close.